You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, What's New for RAC GP Supervisors in 2024, presented by Dr. Jared Ingham. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
Just to explain a little bit more about myself, I'm a GP supervisor myself, both an RAC GP and an ACRM supervisor. And I'm in Jarjawarung country, which is the place where I work is called Daylesford. And I'm the national clinical lead for supervisor and practice support and education. So we have some learning objectives. Mostly we're aiming to talk about what's new in 2024. I'm ably joined by my support panelists, Sky Bogen, Paula Hegarty and Vanessa Moran, who many of you will know. In terms of what I'm covering, I won't really be addressing things like placement or payments or other than supervisor professional developments or terms and conditions or problems with your registrar or teaching tips. We're really covering what's new for supervisors in 2024. So I'll be talking about the change of terminology to designated supervisor, making it clear what your expected supervision requirements are. If you can't meet those requirements, how you can request approval and when that might be given. Talking about leave policy, making clear the number of registrars that are allowed per designated supervisor, the workplace-based assessment program, the number of changes in next year, just building on from what we've already done. Talk about exciting new payments for supervisor professional development, which we're calling SPD. Briefly mentioning, well, another topic, the SPD requirements for culturally safe practice, work in progress. Talk about continuing this automatic accreditation of CPD hours and briefly plugging remote supervision, which I know was a topic of another webinar, the GPSA. So change. Look, there isn't as much change as last year, but we are aware that there is change. And for many of us, we're getting a fair bit of change fatigue. What we did learn from starting this year is the importance of communication. I think we've really gone all out to communicate changes and the changes that are coming, even though they're less than before. And we've had meetings with supervisor liaison officers, the practice manager liaison officers. We've had the national webinars. We've got actually an update module, which you'll be able to click through. It'll be available both on GP Learning and on the RACGP webpage in a similar format to we had the introduction to the 2023 module. That's about to be released. The supervisor and practice manuals and guides are being updated. I'm about halfway through. Then there'll be regional communication. So what I'm talking about is the national communications, but then regionally specific communications will come. And you've got your local training coordinator, who probably is, you know, when it comes down to it, that's your first port of call. So terminology, the first change we're going to talk about is the change from primary supervisor to designated supervisor. We did go into this year with the idea that we would have primary and secondary supervisors, and that would refer to a different kind of level of training, because we thought we'd be able to get more supervisors into training by having a lesser role, the secondary supervisor who didn't have as much to do and only had a smaller training requirement. I don't think we communicated that very well, and there was a fair bit of resistance to it. It was seen as hierarchical, and there wasn't identified that there was much need. So in the end, we decided to drop that. There is a small number, about 30 supervisors around the country who have been trained as secondary supervisors, and they'll now need to be trained up as fully fledged supervisors. And we've got a plan for that. Just to explain, the designated supervisor, it's the same definition as we had for the primary supervisor. It's the accredited supervisor in the practice who accepts full responsibility for the registrar and coordinates the practice supervisory team for that registrar. And that designated supervisor is linked to the registrar and the training management system. It's our main point of contact regarding the registrar. If we want to contact the practice as a whole, we're probably more likely to contact the practice manager. And if you think about it, if you're a practice, you've got multiple registrars, you may choose either to have multiple designated supervisor, one designated supervisor for each registrar, or you may choose to have one designated supervisor with multiple registrars. There is a restriction. You can't have more than three registrars per supervisor. We'll get more to that later. We need to communicate three kinds of supervisor. We've got the designated supervisor we've just been talking about, and then there are other accredited supervisors in the practice. And so the designated supervisor is the main person and the other accredited supervisor in the practice. And then there are people who in an emergency will fill in or in very lesser circumstances. And they are people who are a specialist GP, because we never want someone to be a GP registrar to be supervised by someone who's not a specialist GP, but they haven't done the accreditation training. And thinking about this, Simon mentioned we're good friends and we play together in a band, and I thought the designated supervisor is a bit like the lead singer. So Simon's the lead singer, he's out the front, and that's the main person doing most of the work. Okay, then you've got doing most of the performance. Then you've got the rest of the band. They're all important, the other accredited supervisors. Whereas really everyone else is the people in the audience, and in amongst the audience, and that's probably a musician, someone who thinks that they can play and can perform, but they've actually not been to rehearsals. So they're people who we will allow them to get up on the stage or do their stuff in a certain circumstances, but they're not really meant to be the prime supervisor. So then if we think about how do we use these different types of supervisors in what different circumstances, basically the RACGP has long had the standard that the standard of supervision, the supervision requirement should match the competency of the registrar. And until recently, we'd never sat down and really said, well, what is the competency of registrars at different levels as they make their way through training? And how should that supervision requirement match that competency? And we've now done that work. For those of you who want to go and look at it, you can see the progressive capability profile of the general practitioner. And it divides GPs in training into four stages. The entry, which is that first 4 weeks, the registrar arrives in the practice. We don't know that their skill level can be incredibly varied from being, you know, someone who's done lots of general practice training in the past through to someone who's never stood inside an Australian general practice, and maybe their training might have been in a different specialty. And then after about the first 4 weeks or so, once you've figured out what they're like, they move into a foundation level where they're really safe to practice. They're getting more confident and competent, and you're happy. You still want to monitor them closely, but you don't have to review every case that they patients that they see. And then consolidation, which is GPT3 and extended skills in general practice training. So that final year of general practice training, during which you can have a not as tight a supervision. Then of course fellowship, when you have completed GP training and no supervision is required. So if we look at the level of supervision at each of those levels, so I'm going to talk about entry. So that's that first 4 weeks. And during that first 4 weeks, until you know that your registrar is safe to consult without you reviewing every one of their cases, you need to review every one of their notes. This standard has always been there, so you need to review them by sitting in or being called in or just reviewing their notes. And you need to do this until you are confident. It doesn't have to wait for the 4 weeks. You might be confident before then, but once you're the first step is for you to review everything. And for during that time, that obviously has to be done by an accredited supervisor, and you have to be on site, because how can you be reviewing or be available all the time? So that first period of time, the milestone, the entry milestone, you need an accredited supervisor. As I mentioned, you then move on to the foundation. At this stage, no longer need to have every case reviewed. You can use a clinical supervision plan, which describes, you know, when you should be called and how you were called and, you know, what sort of matters you'd be called about. And during that time, it still has to always be an accredited supervisor. They're still not really up to the standard where you would be allowing the musicians who's in the floor to come and supervise them during that time. But there is a lesser requirement for you to be on site. 80% of the time you only have to be on site, but the other 20% of the time you have to be able to attend if you're called. And then, as I said, we move on to consolidation. And when you, again, cases are reviewed according to a supervision plan, but it's at this stage where we allow another specialist GP, the third type of supervisor I mentioned, to be available for the supervision 20% of the time. So they need an accredited supervisor, either the designated supervisor or an assistant supervisor, there for 80% of the time, and the remaining 20% to be done by a specialist GP. Again, it's never appropriate for a registrar to be supervised by a non-specialist GP. The time that you need to be on site is dropped down. I just want to make clear, when we talk about available, we mean that you are available, you're not overloaded, and you can be easily contactable and able to attend. And those percentage requirements, if it says 80%, we don't think that means you're 100% available for 80% of the weeks and 0% available for the remaining 20% of the weeks. That, you know, if there's periods of a week or more absence of an on-site supervisor, then we need to be notified. So then the person, who do you notify? The training coordinator. And I just mentioned that specialist GP, which I'm hammer home that point. So when can you vary those supervision requirements? And I mentioned that the timing of change from entry to foundation, from review of every case and to reviewing under a supervision plan, is your call. You don't need to let us know, but you do need to document your determination, and that's done in the early assessment for safety and learning, which we'll talk about shortly. Beyond that, if you had a need or there was reasons why you believe that you should be able to transition from the foundation states to consolidation from the GPT-2 to the GPT-3 version sooner than later, then you'd need to be getting ME approval, you know, through contacting a training coordinator. In simple terms, at the start of GPT-1, an accredited supervisor is on site and reviews all cases, even if it's just by checking the notes, until you determine that that's not needed. You document that in the easel. For the remainder of GPT 1 and 2, it still has to be an accredited supervisor. We won't accept other levels of supervisor. Must be supervising, but the requirement drops back to 80% of the time. And if you want to change that, this is not something you can make the call on. You need to speak to your training coordinator who will speak with ME. And for in the last part of training, that's when a specialist GP who is not accredited can act as a supervisor for 20% of the time. And the minimum on-site requirement is 50%. Just want to briefly mention that, of course, the other element when you think about who's covering is the supervisor leave policy. And the main issue tends to be in small practices with a very limited supervisor pool. And you really need to have a contingency plan for unexpected leave. And you need to notify us if there's any supervision shortfall. What might we do? We might approve an alternative supervision arrangement. We might arrange remote supervision. And in rare circumstances, if we had a registrar not being supervised, then we have to withdraw them from the practice because, of course, their training time wouldn't count towards fellowship if they were unsupervised. Next one, I mentioned briefly before that there is a requirement which is consistent with the medical board requirement, and you just need to think of the count from Sesame Street, the count 1, 2, 3. That's how many registrars you can supervise. And so there's a maximum of 3 supervised doctors per supervisor, irrespective of training fraction. So if you've got a half-time registrar, that counts as 1. Level of training, if the GPT-1 or GPT-3, it counts as 1. And training program, if you've got an ACRM registrar or a RACGP registrar, an FSP registrar or an IP registrar or a medical board doctor under supervision, they all count as 1 as far as we're concerned. Obviously, we don't know about people in the other programs, so we might inadvertently place someone in your practice when we didn't know that you already had 3 supervised doctors. So you shouldn't misinterpret a placement approval as us approving a greater number. You need to let us know. Before we move on to the workplace-based assessment, I'm just going to pause and see if there are any questions that I need to answer at this stage or someone else needs to answer.
Hi, Jared. We do have one question from Tali. What is the RACGP checking process regarding appropriate supervision of registrars?
Okay, so in terms of, well, we write those guidelines and we provide that education to you. Generally, I would say we would only be monitoring or supervising those if we were to hear that there was a problem. So generally, when an ECT visitor goes to a practice, they might ask how the supervision is going, but we're not scouring. We might ask you to produce a supervision plan. You don't have to submit your supervision plan, but you do have to have one. But we don't have an active visiting auditing process. We actually regard our practices as high quality practices, as academic institutions who we're dealing with, and we expect and trust that you'll do the right thing. But of course, if we do hear something or a concern is raised, then we would ask for, you know, evidence that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Thanks.
Anyone from anyone else?
Jared, I just want to make a little observation. I was at a very excellent session at Wonka recently run by a local medical educator, which was a thrill, at an international conference.
Lovely.
And she was talking about the whole notion of availability and approachability and just speaking to what you're talking about. And one of the local supervisors said his strategy is always to book himself really lightly in the first few weeks. And he said he looks forward to it like a holiday. And he genuinely does. Every 6 months he has this quiet period of his own clinical load, but he's absolutely available for his registrar. And it just struck me as a simple thing. And I know clearly that's a cost impulse, but it meant for him, he was available. The registrar really could seek his support. So a simple strategy.
I think the evidence is that the most important thing in GP training is that the supervisor is approachable and available. And if you're not very available, you very soon become not very approachable. You get cranky when you've been called when you're not expecting to. In my own practice, having done the research that I did and been involved with this, and actually hearing of, like, in where Paula is up in JCU, they actually had a trial of, you know, making a period. So I had 2 weeks where we actually did wave consulting with our registrars and the supervising. We had a number of registrars, and the supervising doctor, had nothing booked in. Also know from work that you and Parker McGinn have done through recent that the average number of times that the registrar calls their supervisor in the middle of a GPT-1 is two per session, so four times a day. So if you think about that, you really need to cross out four consults per day, and that's at the midterm. And by the midterm of GPT-1, they're starting flying. So we all know how much more they're doing it earlier on. So yeah, I do think when you make that step, and it's so much better, the registrars love it, and I'd have to say investing that time early on, you very quickly get a sense of your registrar's capability and the relationship develops, and I actually think investing a bit of time earlier pays off. And that time counts as teaching time as well, time spent talking over cases with them. Keep going. The workplace-based assessment changes. So continuing is the mid and end of term assessments, which we've been doing. New for many is the early assessment for safety and learning, which I mentioned briefly before. It actually did start in August, but that was only for people who had a GPT-1 registrar. So that's been, and then there's mini CEX, which is mini clinical evaluation exercise, and that's consultation observation. So for those of you familiar with that, we've all done similar things to that in our RTOs previously, and RCA, random case analysis, which is something Simon Morgan and I know a little bit about. And you're required to do two of each of those assessments in GPT-1 and GPT-2. There are up on the webpage, guides have been developed for all of those assessments as well as GP learning modules. And they're in the, if you go to the supervisor resources page, that's where they will be. Let's talk about the early assessment for safety and learning, which is called EASL. Why do we do this? We've talked about that. The registrar, when they start, they've just got so much more varied competencies when they arrive in GP training than they did perhaps in the past when everyone came through the Australian Medical Graduate Program and everyone had much the same skills. As I said, we've got this broad extent from those who've got very minimal experience through to very experienced. And so for you to create a safe environment, you really need to understand. It obviously has advantages in terms of we detect any early need for intervention. So we as the RACGP can get in there and give you some help and provide extra support when that's needed. We obviously do our best at selection to hopefully that's not picked up, but you never know until someone's in the practice. It informs our supervision needs and it identifies the learning needs and helps you to design your teaching plan. I mentioned that we've already tried EASL and we made a commitment with all of our workplace-based assessments that when we introduced WBA, that we would spend time, you know, evaluating the programs. And the initial evaluation of EASL, because I don't think it's much different from what many RTOs were doing previously, has been very positive. It's been received very well. We obviously still doesn't mean we can't do better and we're not adjusting it. We already have made some adjustments in response to feedback that we've had. So what is the EASL assessment? It consists of basically these parts. It's a registrar multiple choice questionnaire. So the registrars, and many of them will be receiving this soon, they get a multiple choice questionnaire. It's a broad range of GP skills. They not only rate their answer, but they rate their confidence in their answer. And the value of that for you as a supervisor or as a practice, or particularly as a supervisor, is that you get to see if a registrar answers that they think they know the answer to something and it's wrong, and they're very confident about it, that's a bit of a red flag, a bit of a warning that they're not aware of it when they don't know something. Then the next thing you have to do, you have to observe at least four consultations. You can observe more. And that's really to give you a strong sense of their communication skills. Because you think about it, before you let a registrar loose without routine review, you want to know they've got that foundational skills. So you want to know that they can detect a patient's agenda, that they can, you know, arrange a follow-up consultation, that they can safety net, that they can detect when they're not going well in a consultation, and that they can explain things clearly. And if you've got those things, you're going to be much more confident if they've got those core consultation skills, because after all, that's what a lot of complaints and issues come from. But then to get a stronger sense of their core foundational knowledge, in addition to the MCQ answers and in addition to the four consults, at least that you've observed, there's a process of reviewing all of their notes. And so, as I mentioned at the start, you're reviewing all of their notes every day, reviewing those until you decide you don't need to do that. And from those notes that you review, you're likely to select a number of those notes to have a discussion with the registrar. And you'll probably do that either at the end of the day or even more likely for the the start of the following day. And you keep doing that. So it's called daily case review. And that very quickly gives you a strong sense. I mean, obviously you could do what I've done, which is, you know, wave consulting or more intense processes, but I suppose we've set that as the bar for something for you to attain. And supervisors around the country who've done this, and I mentioned the evaluation, have responded very positively. But you only have to do it as long as you think you have to do it. Then you have to fill out a summary report. And at the easel, the assessment is always, is the GPR at foundation standard, which I introduced before. Foundation standard is the standard which a registrar no longer needs to call you for every case. So then what happens after that? Well, then, as I mentioned, you stop regular review. Then you've got to develop your ongoing plan. When you're not reviewing every case, what's going to happen? The registrar has been given the call for help list, which was work done through previous research, which was a list of common circumstances where supervisors and registrars, experienced supervisors and recent registrars identified, look, these are circumstances where a registrar should call for help. So we ask the registrar to complete that list and self-evaluate and to bring that list for a discussion with you. We're not expecting that you tick off every item in the list or that every item in the list is kept in your supervision plan, but it's a basis for you to have a discussion. So your plan then, your supervision plan, is based upon what you've observed in EASL, what you've learned about the registrar's previous experience and their self-assessed confidence and that call for help list, okay? And then your other job is to discuss the EASL performance summary with the registrar, especially if you've raised an amber or red flag. There's nothing worse for a registrar or for the medical educator who receives it to get an amber or red flag about a registrar and the supervisor hasn't discussed that with the registrar. I appreciate that's difficult, and often the supervisor reluctance to fail or failure to fail is well known and can feel uncomfortable. So if you're having difficulty with that, you've got a registrar, just reach out to us and see. We'll be very keen to help you. But don't just post an EASL performance summary without discussing it. So then what must be recorded in the TMS, the training management system, each of the four observed consultations, a summary of performance, and at least one learning goal. That's all you've got to record. You're not required to record any discussion you have about the multiple choice, the cases you've reviewed, the call for help, or the supervision plan. But it is a requirement that you maintain a clinical supervision plan for your registrars. And when you do the EASL, you'll see a link to the clinical supervision plan. You can download it and create yours. It's also, again, available in that resources for supervisors page. So what are the outcomes at the end of that? We've confirmed that they're ready to progress to foundation level. We've flagged anyone who needs more help. We've got a clinical supervision plan. And from the learning needs, we've developed a teaching plan. As I mentioned, there is further help with the EASL. There's an EASL guide, which is just about to be posted up. There is a GP learning module, and there's a webinar recording from when we first introduced it with Tony Soltis and I. That actually demonstrates the EASL on the TMS, and you can actually see how the assessment's completed. I want to move on to the other two new assessments, which are the mini CEX, mini clinical evaluation exercise, and the random case analysis. Again, guides and GP learning modules available. So mini CEX, it's a slightly different version of consultation observation, but very familiar to all of us supervisors. Random case analysis, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is the process of a supervisor selecting a recent registrar record and then having a conversation based upon that record, and ideally using the domains of general practice as a basis for your questions, particularly those in domain 2 and 5 about the clinical reasoning and the organisation and records that you've kept, but also you can extend that conversation using what if questions to think about circumstances where the problem, the patient, the doctor or the system is different, and that's in the guide. And these assessments, unlike the EASL, ask, is the registrar fellowship standard? So whenever you're doing a midterm or mini CX or random case analysis standard, the assessment is, are they at fellowship standard? Of course, most GPT1s and GPT2s are not going to be at fellowship standard. We wouldn't be expecting them to be that way. But the reason for doing it, this is you can say, well, this is what you need to do to get to that standard. It encourages you as a supervisor to break down those skills and help you to work on that. You will also be asked, you know, are you concerned about this registrar? And it's a flagging process. And that's where, if you did that, a medical educator would be in contact with you. How we're doing that at the start of 2024 is that we downloadable forms of access to the training management system. They're not on there at the moment. They will become available as we move into the 2024 year. You must complete 2 of each in GPT1 and 2 of each in GPT1. GPT-2. So if you think about that, one mini CX and one random case analysis probably takes you 3/4 of an hour. You do that in a teaching session, completed that. So just schedule off one teaching session. And it's ideal you can do one of those before the midterm assessment and another combination of them before the end of term assessment. So you could actually probably complete all the assessments in, you know, two teaching sessions. You must keep this form in your practice. We're not asking you to submit it unless you have particular concerns about the registrar's performance, but we may ask you for it, particularly if later on the classic circumstance would be, you know, a registrar who you thought was good, but later on another supervisor didn't think was so good. So we want to look back and see, you know, look at the previous assessments to make sense of what's gone on. We do have future plans to make these assessments like the EASL, to make them completely online, which would make recording easier and flagging work better. And that's finished, WBA.
Gerard, Frank asks about, we'd love to do more direct observation for many more hours, but a challenge when we are financially constrained. And I know Frank asked that question before. You talked about doing mini CXs and RCAs as teaching sessions. So
yes,
certainly we see these assessments as being paid.
Yes,
because completely. We very much consider these part of those teaching sessions. And we only do run those during those terms that are funded for.
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned, I think there's part of EASL, which will be in your early teaching sessions, those observations in those. And then I said one RCA and one mini CX, so probably 3/4 of an hour between the two. And do that twice a term, that's another hour and a half. We do really see them as assessment activities. You know, we do think that we have adjusted in response to feedback the number of assessments that's required, and we're evaluating these. We'll look to see whether it's too much, too little. You know, are we getting the right amount of information about our registrars based upon that? Okay, so I want to now talk about continuing professional development and supervisor professional development. And again, in addition to the different types of supervisors, the different types of professional development seem to cause a bit of confusion when I've spoken about it the other night, so I'm just going to spend a moment explaining it. So first of all, if we think about the role of a GP supervisor, you're a dual professional. You're both an expert clinician, but you're also an expert educator. Okay. And a GP supervisor can be seen as a GP with a special interest, just like a GP with a palliative care or women's health or anaesthetics or whatever it is. It's a special interest. And so you need professional development for your role as a GP, but you also need professional development for your special interest. And so your special interest professional development should count towards your GP professional development because it's part of your GP role, your GP with a special interest. So you do have the standard 50 hours CPD requirement, and that's the same as you've always had. But you do have this additional specific requirement for supervisor professional development. You can think of that as a subset of your overall requirement for CPD. So SPD education is accepted as CPD, so things along tonight, that's accepted as CPD, as you know, this is an accredited activity. But education directed primarily at clinical skills will not be accepted as SPD. So, you know, the sort of thing, if you go along and learn, you know, demoscopy, that's not going to count as improving your education skills. And so that's how we determine whether something is or isn't. The other thing which causes the confusion is the RACGP, and I'm talking about this a bit later, the RACGP, we recognise that the act of being a supervisor is a GP professional development activity. You're spending all your time, you're reflecting on what you're doing, what you do as a GP, and you're teaching about it. So we've been awarding 30 hours automatically to a designated supervisor and 20 hours to other supervisors. And so I think that's part of the reason. So you have a CPD requirement of 50 hours, and we're awarding you up to 30 hours in that CPD requirement because you're a supervisor. You then also have a specific supervisor professional development activity, which this in 2023 we had no requirement, but in 2024 we will have a requirement. Okay, but the requirement will be per practice rather than for individual, and the supervisor professional development requirement will be 3 hours for every 6 month GP registrar term in your practice, be it GPT1 through to extended skills and general practice. It's called GPT-4. So that'll be 3 hours, and it totals up the number of registrars. And that's how each supervisor within the practice contributes to that total. It's up to the practice. I mean, you know which of your supervisors need to do more professional development, which don't need as much. And you could make that accordingly. In terms of payment for it, we are the only college that pays for supervisor professional development, but we're not paying for it directly on a per hourly basis. We're providing a practice stipend. So $500, which if you think of that for the minimum 3 hours is $166 per hour. for the minimum hours. But of course, you may choose to do, and we hope you do more than that, but you're only required to do that a minimum amount, and that's what you'll be paid. So it's a practice SPD stipend, but that only goes up until you get to 4 registrars in the practice. To head off the questions at the pass, we are aware that this has an issue in terms of it can be potentially a risk with payroll tax. This payment is to the practice in the same way that teaching payments are currently to the practice. If you only had one supervisor and you want to put just that one supervisor's details in the training management system, then the payment will be made to that one supervisor. But otherwise, you know, the RACGP couldn't be advocating more strongly against payroll tax and doing our best to, you know, Nicole Higgins' work is just monumental in this space. We hope that we can get around it that way, but we are aware of what we've done. But the prospect of having the banking details of 6,000 different supervisors and trying to manage every hour and half an hour that people did and whatever was just really beyond really what we could possibly do. We'd be spending all our time working on that. So we have made this decision. And we also think it hands over the responsibility to, again, it's this ethos of believing the practice is best to know what's best for it. So we're not out there monitoring you or closely running a fine tooth comb over you all the time. We're giving you these broad requirements. But if we have complaints or hear issues, then we would come and visit. We've made it clear what we're expecting. In simple terms, what will you be paid? If you have 4 or more registrars, you'll earn $2,000 per 6 months or $4,000 per year for professional development. And you choose how you want to allocate that. So in terms of how we make that payment, you won't have to do a thing other than enter your supervisor prank details into the training management system. We will track your attendance at any accredited supervisor SPD activity. We will load that up as an event that will be tracked within our training management system, and they'll be able to total up the number of hours done by the all accredited supervisors in the practice and be able to keep a track of it that way. Payment, we will be paying you because, again, we're presuming that you're going to do it. Payment will be made presumptively, but we'll just, if you haven't done the required hours, we'll pause the payment until you have, and then the payment will resume. And again, so I think, you know, this sort of stipend payment, routine payment, very clear. You know, you don't have to complete multiple forms and activities that should make it, I'm hoping, smooth. But we'll hear if not. There are other payments available. MMM 4 to 7 supervisors will be able to claim reimbursement for travel and accommodation. There is some talk about trying to extend that to MMM 3. Those of you who feel that should happen strongly, perhaps you might want to give some feedback to the college. There will be regional variation in what is considered eligible for SPD. We know that the supervisor professional development run by Sky in New South Wales ACT is different from that run by Paula in far north Queensland. And we need to allow those regional educators, highly skilled, to make the determination about what is acceptable. In regions which will struggle to meet the requirement, it might be that you'll be allowed to credit things like attending this GPSA webinar or completing online modules will be allowed to be accredited. But at the moment, what is eligible for supervisor professional development, what counts towards your requirement, is varies according to the region. And our regional teams will be in contact through newsletters and through the training coordinator to explain what they're offering and what you're expected. Can I also say, really importantly, we're working hard with ACRM and with universities and hospitals to try and reduce the duplication of SPD requirements. As someone who is both an RACGP and an ACRM supervisor, the last thing that I want is to have to do separate meetings and separate supervision, education, professional development for each college. I appreciate that there are, I mean, obviously tonight you need to learn a little bit about the RACGP assessments, which are different from the ACRM assessments, but fundamentally the work of being a supervisor is the same regardless of the training or workforce program that you're in. And so we are meeting, and I want to acknowledge the support and meeting from Coralie and Dean at ACRM and from Kyra Moss and others, Isabel Broderick, and those that I meet regularly, and we're trying to make things work. We're quite hopeful in GPSA being involved as well. We're quite hopeful, particularly maybe if we can just get it rolling in a couple of states and then roll it out nationally as we make our way through. It is logistically challenging. We've been talking about existing accredited supervisors. New supervisors will continue to be fully funded up to 12 hours for the Foundations of GP Supervision program. This program goes up to 12 hours. Previously, people were allowed to do some of it online or can do it fully online. From now on, from 2024, AGPT supervisors have to do some component in a workshop or face-to-face, because we believe that the professional identity formation and that becoming part of this wonderful network of GP supervisors really only happens when you start to meet with your colleagues. And really, that there's been a lot of, you know, when are we going to be able to meet face-to-face? When are we going to be able to do what we used to do? And we're really focused on doing that more and more. The foundation program is 7 core modules prior to accreditation, and we're very excited about module 8, which we've just run for a few times. This involves supervisors taking a video of themselves doing one of the 3 core skills which we've identified in the foundations program. That is providing feedback after a consultation, discussing a problem case, maybe using Simon's PQRC method, discussing a problem case, or doing random case analysis and observing that, and we give them some feedback either in a small group or individually. You'll be able to submit those videos through GP Learning. That's going to be up there soon as well. I just want to mention, we acknowledge country at the start and the important work that we're doing in collaboration with ACRM and JCTS, that's the Joint College Training Services, cultural educators and mentors there. We really are working on developing a clear path and statements regarding the requirement for culturally safe practice. You may be aware that if you're a new GP supervisor in RACGP, you actually have to complete cultural awareness education before you get accredited. We're now looking at, we've been trying to embed some cultural education into the existing education, but we're also starting to look at whether we can do some specific cultural education, and I think there's more work in this space. I think I'd be logging any cultural education activities that you do, keeping a record of that for accreditation requirements in future, but there are none listed currently. But I think this is important work, and I'm looking forward to working with ACRM and JCTS to advance that further. I mentioned earlier, we're up to the 9th of my 10 points, that the automatic allocation of CPD hours recognises that our supervisors in teaching and supervising are advancing their skills as a GP. And so we'll continue to award automatically 30 hours for a designated supervisor and 20 hours for all the other accredited supervisors in a practice with a registrar, GPT 1 to 3. Because this is a reviewing performance activity, if you get the document which explains why you're getting this, there is a requirement that you do a review of your performance. And that's why that people continually ask me, oh, I never get any evaluation of my teaching and my supervision. And then I say, well, have you asked your registrar? You know, a meeting with your registrar and with other supervisors in your practice where you sit down and talk about, well, how's teaching gone? And were there times when, has supervision gone? Have there times when you called for help and you couldn't get it? Well, what would you have liked to have happened differently? And, you know, I like to teach this way. Does that work for you? You know, you can seek evaluation. That's a simple review of your performance and teaching. That is a requirement of that. There will be a new document sent out in January 2024, which we decided that you're not really that focused on 2024 CPD until that comes. Hopefully you're all busily finishing your various professional development plans if you're an RACGP CPD person at the moment, and we'll have a new plan for you. But I just want to reassure you that that current process is continuing. So getting back onto this CPD and SPD thing. So being a supervisor contributes towards your annual CPD requirements. A designated supervisor receives 30 hours of CPD, but your practice as a whole has an SPD requirement of 3 hours per registrar term. How each supervisor contributes towards that is a matter for the practice. Regional teams will advise what activities are eligible, and we will be paying routinely based upon the banking details in the training management system, a stipend of $500 per term being paid to the practice for supervisor professional development. Brief plug, remote supervision. Please, if you're someone who has worked remotely and has the skills and would be interested in being a remote supervisor, that would be really good if you could be in touch. We're very keen to promote the exciting work of Jill Benson and Tim Linton in this space. There's been a lot of information, and I'm sure you're not going to have taken that all in, but where else can you go? Local training coordinator, local training coordinator, local training coordinator. That's where you go. That person is usually, well, you can identify that in the training management system. The registrar's training coordinator is listed there. You may also see your local medical educator listed there as well. You have supervisor liaison officers, wonderful people who you can make contact with, and there is a list on the RACGP webpage of the supervisor liaison officers. There's also practice manager liaison officers, similarly a list. But if you're not really sure and you're not sure who that person is, you can just ring the general practitioner training support line or send us an email and we will direct you to the correct person. Some questions.
Jared, I thought it might be worth raising. Frank raised a concern about what might happen in corporate practices if the supervisor CPD payment is being channeled through there. Do you have any advice or tips for how someone working in that situation might be able to manage it?
It is a challenge. It's the same challenge which exists for teaching payments, of course, but certainly we're writing into our documents that it's our expectation that that payment is passed on to the supervisors. And if practices aren't doing that, it's actually written into their documents and our expectation that that's being passed on. So, you know, when they come around to reaccreditation or if concerns or things are raised, it should do. I was asked it the other night, you know, what should a supervisor be paid? And I think, you know, probably, you know, if they're not, well, if they're not a practice owner, what should they be paid? And pretty simple, you can go to the nationally consistent payments. You can see an hourly rate that the practice is getting for teaching. And, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable for a supervisor to expect to be paid $200 an hour for teaching. That's my personal view. It's not the RACGP position. But if you actually take those numbers and do the division, this is me speaking as a supervisor. And I've given you the numbers for supervisor professional development. The practice is getting $500 for 3 hours. And if you're going off to doing supervisor professional development, that's obviously a practice conversation. But the RACGP has got a strong position of our expectation that that is handed over pretty much in full to the participating supervisors. You'll notice that new supervisors are paid directly. They're not paid individually. It is tricky. We don't control what happens in the practice.
Obviously, Jared, I imagine people are listening in and thinking about capacity and starting to adopt some of these practices for the new year. As an education provider, we're obviously very happy to support supervisors around some of the things Jared's spoken to: problem case discussion, random case analysis, direct observation, delivery of feedback, those sorts of things. So, you know, they're core supervision skills, but we don't assume that everyone feels wholly confident about those. So if you do have concerns in those areas, maybe let us know, because if there's a bit of a groundswell of perceived gaps, we can try to address that.
I mean, although I think you're better off learning face-to-face or attending a webinar or going, but for those of you who wanted to see, well, you know, when I went through as a supervisor, they didn't have training on random case analysis or they didn't have training on problem case discussion, and you want to see. On GP learning, although they're targeted at new supervisors, and we don't want any new supervisor starting to do the GP learning modules because we are going to do some of it face-to-face. But if you're an existing supervisor and you're interested to dabble and find out what is being taught, they're a great place to learn. They're interactive sessions with videos with familiar people in them, and you can, you know, get a bit of a sense of those core skills, a bit of a refresher. And there's just more than the odd guide on the GPSA webpage as well.
Just a few. Jared, just to take you back to the earlier comment about paying the practice and not the supervisor, question about why give money to the practice with the expectation that's passed on, why not give that directly to the supervisor? I know there's lots of thought behind that.
It's sort of a combination of what was pragmatic. As I mentioned, we've got 6,000 supervisors in the RACGP, and many of them are small fractions and attending and keeping and setting a requirement for each supervisor. If you go back a couple of years ago when a year ago, when the RACGP was resuming training from the RTOs, was that we made a sort of position statement, and we actually think there's three core documents each practice would be looking to have. We want to treat practices as academic institutions, and that each practice they would have within their clear supervision plan, how supervision's going to happen, a clear teaching plan, and a professional development plan. You know, not just higgledy-piggledy, but ultimately we're going to aim to progress to the point where everyone will set about identifying what they need as a practice. So it fits fundamentally within our belief that the practice as an academic teaching institution should be looking at its professional development as a whole, and we should be supporting that as a whole. That's both a fundamental position, which is consistent with our philosophical approach to GP education in the practice and our relationship between the college and the practices, but also a pragmatic thing. If we had 6,000 supervisors and we're having to get 6,000, you know, bank account details and keeping track of the odd hour here and the odd half an hour there. Most of the funds, because we've asked, after all, the RSHGB gets a bucket of money for this, most of those funds would be disappearing in administration, whereas this enabled us to directly fund practices. We also stole this idea from WA, which had run this model. And if I speak to Colleen Bradford, the director of training in WA, she says this worked swimmingly in WA. Practices were very happy to receive the funds and distribute it. And so it gives the college budgetary certainty, and it actually has been tried in the region before and was well received.
We'll never make everybody happy 100% of the time either way. So I think the decision wasn't
easy. And we put a lot of effort into just recently identifying how we can make it even easier, that the payments will happen routinely. You don't have to submit forms. You know, you don't, you know, all that kind of thing. Well, as a supervisor, I hated all the forms I had to fill out. And we've really put a big effort into trying to reduce that amount. You know, it should all be on the TMS. If you go, if someone saw you there or you were attending the webinar, they put it in for you. College staff puts it in. You know, you don't have to remember, who do I send that to? And, you know, how's my signature on the form and how does it get there? And is it GST and all that sort of stuff?
I did want to answer, I'm just mindful of time, we'll probably finish up in a second, but Murray's comment about inviting CT visitors and medical educators to do some joint supervisor professional development and with some overlap. And Murray, we would love to see a, you know, a supervisor or a medical education training stream in something like GP24, where we could absolutely foster that kind of collaboration where we are missing our industry conference GP Tech. So watch this space, Murray. We would love to be able to offer that too. Couldn't agree more.
There is some early work in some regions are talking about, you know, when the supervisor does the ECTV, that they stay in the practice and do this practice review meeting, which we were talking about for your CPD, and provide in-practice professional development. Because it's historically been a problem is that everyone goes away to do their professional development at a wonderful event run by Sky or Paula, and they learn a lot of new skills. And then how do I apply those in my practice? We would love in the future to start to bring more and more professional development to your practice. And we want to thank you for the great work that you do in RACGP training practices.
And thank you very much for your contributions, certainly at GPSA, and I know the RACGP wish to have a strong engagement with supervisors. So it's about a dialogue. And so please contact us, GPSA. Please contact the RACGP. Talk about how it's going for you. And this is the way we can sort of fashion policy to best meet your needs, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, very keen, you know, keen to evaluate, keen to hear, keen to improve. We don't feel like we've landed it in the first year. We're gradually improving and adapting, and I'm sure you'll find the experience a bit smoother in the second year than in the first year. And it's lovely to be able to have a more established professional development program and WBA. So yeah, very keen to hear.
Thanks. Just to invite again members, GPSSA supervisors, to join our community platform if you're interested. And I guess, you know, there's probably no better opportunity to talk about this. You know, there are changes afoot, changes in work practices and the way you'll be functioning. And, you know, this is a platform for discussion of these sorts of things. So please join and continue the conversation. I would like to thank you very much, Jared, and also to Vanessa, Sky and Paula for joining us. And we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much all.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and/or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.